Thank you. Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivajakacharya Sodra Sata Sri Srimad Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada Ki Ananta Goti Vaishnavinda Ki Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Premsikaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki, Sri Sri Radha Krishna, Gopi Gopinath, Shyamakunda Radha Kunda, Kiri Gopadam ki, Vrindavan Dham ki, Mayapur Dham ki, Jagannath Swami ki, Yamuna Mai ki, Ganga Mai ki, Tulsi Devi ki, Ganga Mai ki, Yamuna Mai ki, Kiri Gopadam ki. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pasaya Bhujulai Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namami. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvishesha Sanyavari Pastitale Satarani. I'm going to speak about being a guru and Yes, Pooj's talks. And I won't speak very long, but after I speak, I'll ask for questions. And please ask questions on the topic of the talk. I want to bring this back to the time when Srila Prabhupada passed away. Up until that time, the only meaning of guru was Srila Prabhupada. And we were certain that he was pure devotee and Jagat Guru, that we were in safe hands, and that we could guide everyone to this movement, to the shelter of Srila Prabhupada. When he passed away, we all felt great loss. Although he had set up the movement in such a way that it was a strong movement, ready to continue. His guidance in his books and with a governing body commission to deal with all the affairs, to protect his temples, which were spread all over the world. He even gave us guidelines for the cyclic succession of spiritual masters. And we took it up immediately. but in some ways precociously. You can look back with hindsight, thinking how we did it and say, well, we should have done it another way, we should have done it. More gradually, not introducing so much worship in a high style as the spiritual masters. But we were in a hurry to keep the movement high flying, almost out of a fear that if we didn't do that, it might just collapse. Out of the fear that without keeping the momentum of Prabhupada and book distribution and high leadership, everyone might just leave. I myself was not so eager to take a high profile as a spiritual master, but others were, and I found myself also taking up the awkward position in almost every talk that I gave of trying to explain how I was empowered, a bona fide guru, as if there were no other subject to speak about. There were many persons waiting for initiation because Prabhupada hadn't initiated in a long time. And so I spoke to those groups of people and told them that although I was tiny and imperfect, I was qualified in the disciplic succession. I would quote, and others would quote, a passage from Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, which he gave in a talk to his disciples on one of his Vyas Pooja celebrations, where he very hilariously actually and sarcastically describes himself, and he says, who is this person sitting on a big raised platform listening to his own praises? He says, it looks like some big animal out of a zoo with so many garlands around him, listening to his own praises, and he seems to enjoy it. What a big ego he must have. But no, he says, I will not come down from this position or think that this is wrong, because my Gurudev has told me to take this seat and to speak what Lord Chaitanya has ordered. And he quoted Lord Chaitanya's words to whoever you meet, tell them about Krishna, and then you will never be without me, and you'll meet me, and you'll be with me in this place. So, you may think me a big egotist, but I cannot, under any circumstance, give up this order that my Guru has given me to be a spiritual master and to give this word. So it's a charge that he was given to take the leadership, but he was taking it very humbly. In the mood of a servant, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati always used to present himself as a servant before his disciples. "I'm your servant," he would say. And Prabhupada also is serving us. By bringing us to Krishna. That's a very deep thing. It's a very deep thing to pick up the parampara in the Sutta succession. And we really didn't do it very well, although we attempted to. Some outside observers who were watching our movement, professors and so on, saw how we stumbled and tried to make a good attempt at it. One of our friends, Larry Shin, been following our movement a long time, interviewed the gurus and said that Prabhupada came and his to America and came in the succession. There was a great deal of scholarship and force for preaching. But more than anything else, he had a great deep piety, and which could be heard, he said, in particular in his singing. And none of his disciples were able to carry, he was not able to pass this on to his disciples. He said, "I've met with his disciple gurus, and many of them were very cocky. They said, 'Yes, I'm a guru because, it's in the cyclic succession, so I should be treated as good as God.'" And, he didn't see that piety in them, which was the real keynote of Prabhupada. And so many of us fell into trouble because of not understanding that the guru is really the humble servant of his disciples and the humble servant of his spiritual master. You should never try to forget he is serving Srila Prabhupada in this task that he's taking on. As the years went by, I didn't only lecture on that one topic that I am a bona fide spiritual master. Finally, I began to accept that that I am. A lecture on other topics in Krishna consciousness. But it was a great burden on me still. To think that I had taken this on and had taken on the karma of the disciples who I initiated in such great number. And the times I wished I hadn't accepted the duty, but it was a duty there was no way out of, it seemed at the time. Or if there was any motivation in me to take it for vainglory, it was impossible for me to turn it down. Since everyone else in my peer group who was also awarded the position of guru would not allow me to not be guru. And not only that, but to be the kind of guru that they were. And only now, so many years later, I'm able to be more, I'm not able to retire from guru, being a guru, nor do I want to. I see it more as a fate or a destiny. I see that according to the books, there is supposed to be a disciplic succession, and that the critical student becomes the next guru. So, I'm doing it for Prabhupada just the way I did the first duties I did for him. But I'm doing it from a different perspective, without so many illusions. Without illusions of sitting on a big Vyasasan and allowing so much worship and denying that anyone else could become a guru, and taking on so many disciples so it broke my back, and not allowing my own nature to express itself. That was very unfair. To, among others, to myself. And to the disciples, to whom I couldn't give attention to. What I'm feeling today is more a kind of gratitude. Gratitude that those days are over. I'm grateful that I've come out of the tunnel of the falsity of those days, of having to conform to an idea of ISKCON guruship, especially the conformity I remember at one GBC meeting proposing that I didn't want to sit on a big seat, and so why couldn't it be done individually? If everyone didn't want to do it, let it be done individually by a guru who wanted to do it, let him do it, and others could keep the big seat. And the person who was having the chair at that time, he said, "Oh no, we can't do that." He said, "If we do that," he said, "they'll think that we're not humble. If you do it and others don't do it, they'll think that we're not humble." If you just do it. So it had to be like that, like one person couldn't do a humble gesture. Everyone had to keep the party line. You were not allowed to do something that you felt in your heart was right, was more your style, because it would make the others look bad. And he just frankly said it that way. I felt so trapped. So I'm grateful that those days are over. And I'm grateful that Prabhupada has put up with us all, accepted everyone's service, and tolerated the devotees throughout the years, accepted their service, whatever it was, in the different styles. Even those who have ceased serving, he was grateful. So I should not be feeling superior to anybody, but nonetheless feeling grateful for my release. And I feel grateful to the devotees who are here, who are my caretakers, because I've grown very dependent in many ways. So I'm grateful to you who are taking care of me. And it may seem odd to say on Vyasa Pooja day from the Vyasa San that I'm very grateful to the devotees who are helping me, rather than tell you that you should, what your responsibilities are and what you should do to please me or to spread Krishna consciousness. But actually, I do feel grateful. As I see myself in need of help, and I hope that I can still serve as a spiritual master in a preaching capacity with some help in a better way even than I have done yet. Even in the youthful years when I showed up in so many places and gave so many lectures,
I can do better than I've done yet. By example, and by writing, by being truthful and being myself. I saw those devotees, I didn't read their writings yet, but on this teaching sangha, they were talking about self-authenticity, so that which they read in my books, and that was very important to them. So in the world today, in the world of ISKCON, it's very important to be authentic. And I've been emphasizing that again and again in my writings, in my EJW writings, that we should be true to ourselves, admit our failures, our shortcomings, tear away our masks, and that's the best way to be a real devotee, and admit who you are with a laugh, show warts and all, and before Krishna, admit your weaknesses, and even if you can't admit it before the world, admit it to yourself and to a few confidants. Your shortcomings in sadhana, and you're not even in your lion nature, and be authentic. And then you can start. You can't even start if you don't, if you're a liar. So your truthfulness is the last leg of religion. You have to start being truthful, authentic. So I've been contributing by talking about that in the midst of a lot of inauthenticity. And there are many other things I can find as I write, and as I become more authentic myself. But from this position of dependence and gratitude, because I need help in functioning and sharing love with this small group of disciples and friends who I found here. So I guess that's all I wanted to say. Making a real condensed history of that. Time of guruship and my own no regrets feeling, although it was a period of many regrets, and how I feel now. Now I feel no regrets, but a lot of gratitude for where I've landed. And then it must go, of course, ultimately to my friends, but to Prabhupada and Krishna for taking care of me and letting my rough boat come to smooth sailing. Are there any questions or comments? Larry?
There's a question. And the best way for me to ask it is to first make a comment. And that is that it seems to me a kind of inescapable and somewhat terrifying but realistic irony that in becoming a devotee, in becoming a disciple, and in becoming ultimately a guru, you, and by example and by contrast, each of us, both take on certain responsibilities and duties that we do not want to do, and ones that seem very, can seem burdensome. So you're describing you and your history and how you, there was a time when it became very awkward for you, and especially the worship and the adoration and I think the common lingo would be saying so many people, myself included, had you on a pedestal, or I put you on a pedestal. I'll just speak for myself. So now the inescapable irony is that you go full circle, one goes full circle, and I also realized that I had a responsibility to you and to Prabhupada in doing that, and to myself, that this is how I feel, expecting something of you, or wanting you to replace or substitute or shoulder the need that I had in the wake of that void of Prabhupada's disappearance. I was all too quick to jump on the bandwagon of you being responsible for carrying my lack of purity. That was very comfortable for me and very unfair to you and others. And from this position now today of recognizing what I did then, and realizing that I am struggling with both inescapable responsibilities and feeling burdened by them, and sensing some tiny piece of what you, some very small reflection of what you've been through, but in my own way, understanding that I have to somehow accept those burdens, but at the same time, I want to stay true to myself as you've taught in your progression, in your evolution, in towards authenticity. So, I first of all want to acknowledge that it's a great opportunity for me to have a chance to serve you and to love you and to care for you and with you for you. Because in some way it gives me a chance to give back some small piece of what you've been giving for so long. And I find it ironic because it's difficult and it requires sacrifice. And there are sometimes burdens that come with it. But the truth of it is that I think that comes with the territory. So for the disciple, for me, a disciple, I want to accept the difficulty, and I want to recognize that perhaps that's what you must have thought. You know, oh well, I have to do the best I can. I have to do what I am asked to do. I may not be qualified, and even now there may be blind spots that I'm having that you had then that now you can look back on and see them, and I'm probably having them now, and I don't know what they are because someday I'll look back and I'll say, oh my goodness, you know, I thought this or I thought that. But I just want to be honest with you and say that I feel responsible with you and for the unfairness that occurred in the past. And the question is, and there really is a question, how do I reconcile and cope with my realization of taking on burdens that in some way they feel like over endeavor. It does feel overwhelming, and it can feel like perhaps even, I don't want to go so far as to say inauthentic, but it's definitely challenging. Well, and at the same time, I want to do it because I see that that comes with the territory of being a disciple and being a devotee.
First of all, the mistake of overdoing it is right. It wasn't just done by the gurus, it was done by the whole society. The whole society lifted up the gurus. And the second rank created the chairs and the worship. And the gurus accepted it. But I'm not sure what you're referring to. You're referring to services that you're rendering now to the guru and how they're so, sometimes such a strain for you. And then you're doing things that you're not even sure that they're authentic for you, like creating a whole Mexico or doing a whole, so much caring for, and it's such a burden with all the other things you have to do in your life that you're wondering if this is, if you can really do all this.
And if it isn't just sort of how it is, because that's sort of what you went through too, and I guess I'm relating back and I'm going, well, you know, when you made the choices you made and the sacrifices you made, I think I understand how you must have felt in a small way. I can't understand in a big way. I can't understand in a thousand disciple way. I can only understand for myself.
Well, you shouldn't do anything that you feel is, you know, authentic or is too much for you in regards to me.
That's the irony. I'm question.
Just like with anything else in your life, with all the other burdens, you have to say it's too much. So I'm a department in your life, and if it makes you, you know, just that everything has to be balanced, and your service to me has a place, but it can't just completely exhaust you financially, time-wise, in terms of all the demands that I may be making upon you. You have to be realistic about it. And our Mexico endeavor, my place in it, my place in contrast to your family. Just do the best you can to be a real disciple, but to be true to yourself as a man and as a, let's say, fallible creature. You're feeling a strain, you say, so do what is realistically possible for you. We did that with Prabhupada. We did what we could, and then sometimes there were things we couldn't do. Especially as we grew older. When we were young, we did everything we could for him. We gave him our whole lives. As we grew older, the devotees couldn't quite do everything, as he said. Is that all right?
It seems like by nature, like the word burden, like, you know, the taking on of the burden of caring for others, it's gonna like seem hard, even if it's not a lot. Any burden, it's like a burden or something. And I guess I was thinking about, you know, when Prahlad Maharaj said that he was going to wait for everyone, it's like, it's hard for me to imagine, is he saying that out of love, but then when it actually happens that he is waiting for everyone, that's difficult for him? You know, like the way that you would make a pledge or commitment, like a pledge of loyalty, but then that could end up meaning that you have to go to war and die for someone. So that might be difficult to follow through with, but you would do it because you made the vow or the pledge or the took on the burden.
Yeah.
Or is it actually not difficult for someone like Prahlad Maharaj?
There are people who are who come to the earth as great, great examples. You can't really be followed, but he's a Mahabhagwat. And they're just there to show a path that can't be duplicated, but he did that, and so we can try to do something like that, a little bit like that. You can do it maybe with a few children and a spiritual master and a husband. Be willing to not get harassed by their demands. And be patient and endure. What Prahlad did, Prahlad Maharaj did on the scale of the whole universe. Yeah, we may be asked to not just do something theoretically, but actually pay it up. If we are true to the vows we make, and it's not just lip service, we have to be there for somebody who we said we were there for. As a guru, you say, I'll take care of you. I'll help you back to Godhead. Or as a disciple, you say, I promise to serve you. Or as a husband and wife. Then, it's not just lip service, we have to do it. Even if we don't feel like it, even if it's a rainy day. The people people who love, they don't feel it's a burden, they just... They just feel happy to do it. Yeah.
You described in many times how you were walking down the street and you saw the sign in the window of 26 Second Avenue.
Yeah.
For coming to classes. And other people also came in, like I agree with Kirtan Ananda, who had taken the Jaladutta across the ocean to find the Guru and then come back. Found Prabhupada right there in the neighborhood. But when you came, you just seemed to be coming for classes. You saw a little sign in the window and thought, well, I'm familiar with this kind of literature. I'd like to hear some Aswami speak. But you didn't say, I was desperately looking for a spiritual master at that time. You didn't, in your writings and as you spoke about it, you didn't describe it like that. But you went and you heard, and was there, what was it? Because Prabhupada didn't always say, as you described your first presentation, that I had to say, well, I'm a bona fide guru in the civil succession because I've been asked, what, how did that come about that you accepted within yourself that even though I wasn't looking for a guru, I seem to have found one, what am I going to do about it? What was that like?
Oh. Well, I was desperately looking for love and for guidance. I didn't have it like in my mind that I wanted guru and everybody went to India. But I was really at my rope's end. And I was thinking about this idea of, I remember some people have put it that they were looking for truth. Oh, it's going to come out when I read my poem, I'll tell you, but maybe I'll save it for then.
Yeah.
But, but my answer is just that I was desperately looking for him. I never met any gurus per se, but then he started talking about love and God and Krishna, and I had been a God brought up person, so that got uncovered and I became again religious, and I became again a son of a family, which I have since given up, thinking how strong that I was going to be a son of him, just my father. And all those things came out strongly, familial connection, God connection. And then get off the streets. I had a job that was just to supply me with my drugs, so the life of drugs was not really satisfying. It was a desperate kind of thing. My religion was riding while high, but that was really a false kind of God, and so I saw that it was not really satisfying. I saw the higher taste, and so I dropped the lower taste and went to the higher taste that he embodied. I wanted him. I saw that I wanted him. So just near that time, somebody asked me, one of my close friends, Metnik, asked me, because he saw that I wasn't moving well among women. He said, Steve, he said, why don't you get married? And I said, I don't know, I feel like I'm waiting for something. And so that's how I was waiting. Waiting for God. And then when he came, then I went for him. So I didn't miss the boat when he came. I tell you that more in the poem when I said. Yes?
I have a question about karma. You are free to answer or not.
Right.
You are mentioning in your talk that upon accepting disciples, you also took up their karma.
Yeah.
And this is not really clear to me. I need some clarification. How this is so? Because according to my understanding, as you serve Prabhupada and as you serve Krishna, whatever karma is there, that becomes Krishna's property. Krishna takes up all karma. As we surrender to Guru and Krishna, he takes up all karma. So the thing that I don't really understand, how our Guru takes up our karma and how he's burdened by it.
Well, maybe or maybe not, he gets it. In the Nectar of Devotion says, a guru should not take on too many disciples. Therefore, it's said, Krishna, in the line of Lord Chaitanya, but if you don't take disciples, then the movement won't be spread. But the guru of Gaudiya Sampradaya, if he's a preacher, then he'll be saved from the karma, because it will be dissipated by his preaching. But if he's not very actively preaching, or if he's not very pure, he may get some of the karma. So Prabhupada said at the very end of his life that he passed away, you could say a little early, 82, he could have lived longer. Because he took on too many disciples. Some doctor said that to him, he gave it some credence. He certainly traveled too much. He should have, a physician could have told him that he traveled so much. If he had stayed more in one place in India, his health would have been better. That's a different point. Prabhupada certainly had no karma of disciples. But it's like a mystery to me. I don't really understand it. So when I say it on the kind of dogmatic faith or understanding. I've heard it, I've read it, that the disciples, if they at the time they get initiated, their karma is taken away and the spiritual master takes it. But if they commit more sins, then he may have to suffer a bad dream, or he may get ill. I've read that in Prabhupada's book. So he may fall down, he may get ill. Those things that I've heard about. You should be careful not to take on hundreds and thousands of disciples. Unless you're very, very strong. But it's a risk. That's my answer. I vaguely referred you to different books and things, but I didn't give you anything positive. But you said your understanding is that upon being initiated, all the karma is gone, and there's no karma for any guru to suffer. But I said it's not quite so clear as that. If the disciple goes on sinning, the guru can suffer, and he can suffer, it's stated in some purports, by illness or bad dreams. So he's still got a hold of the disciples' life and activities. Haven't you read some things like that or heard some things like that? Yeah.
Like in perfect answers, perfect questions, and perfect answers. I guess here as Swami is asking something for that, and Prabhupada gives a similar answer.
Oh. Okay. So we can finish this.